Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, they help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Their doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true healing starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
Hannah Murray on TRE in the afternoon.
Joining us on the line now is Matilda Gosling. She's a social researcher specializing in education, social psychology, and issues affecting children and young people. Her new book, Teenagers, summarizes decades of research and expert knowledge to offer parents a roadmap to adolescence. Welcome to the show, Matilda.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for joining us. So I think a lot of parents maybe having their first child, I guess, might be nervous of the teenage years because, you know, over history we've kind of heard that they can be very difficult and teenagers are difficult to deal with. So straight away, parents can be fearing something that might not happen.
Yeah, I think teenagers have an unfortunately bad reputation that they don't necessarily deserve. And actually, one of the very strong findings to come out of the research is that what you expect as a parent is likely to show up. So if you do expect teenagers who go off the rails and treat you horribly, then you're much more likely to end up with a teenager that does that. So actually, the way to go into it really is to have to be pretty optimistic, to have good expectations, to expect the decent side of your child to show up, and then that's much more likely to happen.
Yeah. I mean, how often does it happen that the child has been really good and a nice, pleasant child throughout the first part of their life, and then they hit the teenage years and it all goes horribly wrong? I mean, is that a pattern?
I think it's definitely a pattern that there's change, but it doesn't need to be the pattern from a lovely child to it going horribly wrong. I think there's probably a space in the middle that actually is much more common for most teenagers, which is that they do change and they do separate from their parents. They start to put up barriers and they start to close their bedroom doors and they stop sharing quite so much information. But that's normal and natural, and it's part of a teenager's job, which is to separate from their parents. So they will be leaving home at some point, and the job for them and for parents will be much easier if the relationship is less close than it was at the start of the teenage years. And that's right, it's what should be happening. But at the same time, going horribly wrong doesn't need to happen. And actually, if you as a parent can put in place lots and lots of warmth, but also firm boundaries as well, so having limits and not being afraid to say, actually, there are some points at which I am still a parent, you are my teenager, I'm looking out for your safety and well-being, there are some points where I need to say no, or I need to put in place other limits, then you tend to end up with a teenager that does okay at the end of the process.
Yeah. Yeah. The relationship involves a lot of to-ing and fro-ing and trust and compromise, and you kind of hope and expect that both parties are going to be reasonable. You know, the parenting is going to always come from a good place, and that the parents are going to be reasonable and understanding of the child, and vice versa, that the child is going to be reasonable and understanding of where the parents come from. And I mean, that's obviously in the perfect world, but it doesn't always happen like that, does it?
And I think in normal day-to-day conversations, sometimes that recognition that the parent is coming from a good place can be lost, even when it's true. And that, again, is pretty normal, and it's not a reason to worry or despair. And actually, things will come round again. And I think if you are a warm, consistent presence who, as I said, puts in place appropriate limits, not ones that are kind of overly strict or punitive, but appropriate for the stage of development of the teenager and their own individual personalities as well, then they will come out of that kind of slightly trickier phase feeling as though you've probably got them to the place that they need to be appropriately and with warmth and love and recognize it. But it might feel in the moment as though that isn't that recognition isn't there, but it will come later.
Yeah. And some of the big topics that it's important to talk about with you that you've discovered through all this research, one of the things that I thought was really fascinating is that we need to stop talking or talk less to teenagers about mental health.
Yeah, so I think there's been a very well-intentioned pattern, and this isn't just parents, this is schools, this is the media, it's happening online, where we've sought to talk much more about mental health in an effort to destigmatize it. So that's a great ambition. And the idea is that if you talk more about it, that teenagers will think about mental health in a more positive light. The problem that we've got is that there is some evidence to suggest we may have gone too far with these conversations. So what can happen if you talk about mental health to a kind of large degree? So you're talking about symptoms of poor mental health, for example, about how to recognise anxiety or how to recognise depression. And this is something that can catch the imagination of some teenagers, not all of them, but some of them. And then they start to recognize some of the symptoms in themselves. Sometimes they can interpret normal feelings of worry or sadness as being signals that they might have poor mental health. And then they start to check themselves for other symptoms. And at the point at which they start to believe that they've got a mental health condition, it can cause them to kind of go into themselves, to introspect, to ruminate on these issues. And then that can stop them from doing the things that we know are really good for their mental health, like social connections, getting outside, playing sport. So I think we need to be quite careful. And there are some really interesting research studies in this area. So there have been a few studies done in schools where teenagers have been split into two groups, and one group just carries on as normal or just receives some fairly kind of anodyne training about something. And another group will get an active mental health intervention where they're taught about mindfulness or cognitive behavioral therapy or something of that nature. And in some of the studies, they've got to the end of it and found that those that were trained in mental health have seen worse mental, that their mental health decline over the course of the intervention, whereas those in the do nothing group came out at the end of it absolutely fine. So I think we need to be really careful about these conversations and treat mental health lightly, and help teenagers recognize that actually it's part of the human condition, that sometimes we feel stressed about exams or we feel sad about the end of a relationship, and that if they can recognize that these are kind of normal feelings and they're feelings that will pass, then it helps them to move through them. I think the danger point comes when they start to wrap these ideas of mental ill health into their identity, because then it becomes much harder to shake it off.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I heard an interview recently with Ruby Wax, and she was talking about the depression that she'd suffered for many years throughout her life. And she was talking, obviously, I appreciate there are different levels of depression and with mental health issues, but she was explaining, in her opinion, what depression was and how utterly debilitating it was. And she kind of felt that people use it as a, well, yeah, as a bit of a label, as you said, and it's kind of banded about too easily, just through someone feeling a bit sad or a bit low, or I'm depressed, as if it's a fashionable phrase to use, and it shouldn't be used like that, because it is a serious condition.
But I think also it can almost become a self-fulfilling prophecy. So if you're a teenager, when identity is they're kind of searching for their identities. And if you suddenly present them with depression or anxiety as being labels and identities that they can hook onto, then it can cause them almost to develop further symptoms of that just by the nature of believing that they have the condition. Because as I was saying, they'll check themselves for symptoms and they'll start to kind of ruminate and go into themselves. Mm-hmm. So you can almost create the conditions by believing at the start you have it, when actually actually it might just have been something that passes. And the other thing is there are some teenagers that do have serious mental health conditions, and if you've got a kind of much larger group that are being wrapped into those definitions, then you don't have the support available there for those that really need it.
Yeah, for sure. Another thing that you talk about in the book, which is an interesting one, why parents should stop fixing their teenagers' problems.
Yes, which is a very easy thing to say, and it's a much harder thing to put into practice.
So explain what you mean.
So teenagers need to experience healthy stress to become resilient. If you encounter something that's really challenging and you're not sure whether you can manage it, if you do manage it and you come to the end of the process, you learn useful skills that then you can apply to future situations, and it gives you confidence in your own abilities. If you come up against challenges and you have a parent who smooths your path so that you don't actually end up having to engage with them fully yourself, you never have that experience of learning how to kind of hold on to obstacles and get over them, and you don't practice the skills that would allow you to apply them to other situations. So you then get to a point where you're much less resilient as an adult because you haven't had those opportunities to practice resilience and have that kind of faith from your parents that you're able to cope as well. So I think part of it is imparting that message that we have faith in our teenagers. We know that they can handle difficult things, and we can be there in the background. We can talk to them as much or as little as they want us to, but we don't need to kind of swoop in and solve their problems for them. We believe in them to be able to solve their problems for themselves. Obviously, I'm talking about manageable problems. I'm not talking about kind of serious instances of kind of illness or bullying or kind of life crises.
Yeah.
But for example, giving them opportunities to travel independently, or if they're having difficulties with their friends, not rushing in with a solution, but instead saying, well, what do you think you might be able to do about it? Or if you had a friend who was experiencing something similar, what might you advise them to do, so that the solutions are coming from them, not from you?
Yeah, giving them the tools to solve it themselves, as opposed to solving it all for them all the time.
Yes, very much so. And if they never get if they never have the practice to be able to do that, you can end up with quite a kind of fragility going into adulthood, and then a lack of belief that you can manage these things for yourself.
Yeah, and less prepared for the realities of the real world.
Yes, because we all experience challenges all the time, from scales of kind of mild to severe, and it's good to have practice to know that you can get over them.
Yeah, definitely. Another interesting topic is smartphones. You know, we talk about smartphones a lot as being a bad thing, particularly for young people, connected to poor mental health as well, going back for that. And you're saying that instead of looking at smartphones as being bad, it needs to be understood and discussed a lot more that there are some really positive things about smartphones as well as negative, a more kind of balanced view on the subject.
Yeah, and I think to some extent this depends on the teenager as well. So some teenagers are able to use smartphones lightly, to pick them up, put them down, then use them to supplement their lives outside in the real world in a way that's really healthy. So they can use them to support real life friendships, they can arrange meetups, they can support each other online, they can build new skills, they can learn videography, they can learn design, they can learn coding. There are all sorts of ways in which screens can be used to kind of develop hobbies and relationships and find your niche, if it's something you, particularly for those that struggle to do that in the real world. I think there are some teenagers for whom it's very, very difficult to put screens down. And for those, I think we need to be a lot more careful, and we need to help them and provide them with the tools to be able to use screens lightly and carefully. And I think some of the data is really complicated on this, but I think there isn't the data that backs up this idea that there is a clear, direct causal link between smartphone and specifically social media use and poor mental health. There are individual studies where there is clearly a link, but when you actually start pulling all the data together, it doesn't come up with this very strong relationship. It looks as though there probably is one, but it's not massive. So I think we probably need to have slightly more nuanced conversations about smartphones and social media.
Yeah. Another subject which is important, very important to discuss with teenagers, a bit of a heads up if there's any parents with young children listening in the car, you might want might not want to listen to this bit, but the huge importance of talking to teenagers about porn.
So it's ubiquitous, it's absolutely everywhere, and unfortunately teenagers get exposed to it at sleepovers and on the school bus and through videos that are shared through school WhatsApp groups, and it's something that parents can't really control. So what we need to do is give them the tools to be able to think about porn critically, to understand that it does not represent healthy relationships, it doesn't represent real life. There's so much in porn that's incredibly unhealthy for developing minds and adult minds as well. And it provides a model of relationships that can be very kind of objectifying. They can be very abusive. And I think it's very important to teach teenagers that this is not a model of the real world, and that healthy relationships are about respect, they're about desire, they're about mutual consent. And if we don't impart those messages, then the porn industry is going to tell our teenagers something very, very different that will not set them up well for real life.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so important. If parents don't have those conversations with teenagers, then there's absolutely no reason for the kids watching these videos to not think that that's completely normal and that's what a normal relationship looks like, unless someone's told them that it's not. You know, it's perfectly understandable for kids to watch and think, oh, wow, when I'm an adult, that's how it's going to be.
It's very hugely
important.
Yes, and actually critical thinking skills more broadly is something that I talk about in the book, about it is something that is incredibly useful to develop. So for example, when critical thinking skills being applied to social media, if you're looking at photographs on Instagram and they're all beautiful and curated, understanding that probably filters will have been used and a photo will have been selected out of 100 dud ones, and those don't necessarily represent real life either. And applying those critical thinking skills to what you consume on media, so where you're getting your news from, and what you're hearing from your friends, I think that sets teenagers up very well for adult life as well.
Yeah, it would be so easy to think that these photographs of influencers and celebrities or reality TV stars on Instagram, they've just literally got someone to hold their phone and, oh, take a picture of me, please, as if it was that easy. But I've read numerous articles and seen people in interviews talking about the fact that, no, I have lighting here, I've got someone doing my hair, my makeup, and we took hundreds of photos in order to get that one, and it took about 6 hours. It was like a whole afternoon's work. You know, it's a job for a lot of people. It's not just as a simple thing of, oh, handing your phone to your boyfriend and saying, take a couple of photos of me. It's a lot more goes into it.
But it's not just celebrities. It's also understanding that when you see these perfectly curated lives of friends and acquaintances outside school that all look perfect and as though every single moment is full of fun and laughter and beauty, that actually that doesn't reflect reality, that that's just a few snapshots. And if anyone were to do that to their own life and spend a lot of time curating the material, they could probably come up with something similar.
Yeah. Yeah. If you were all to choose a photograph of your Christmas together with your family and friends or whatever, the reality is people are going to pick a photo where everybody looks happy and everyone's smiling and got a drink in their hand and having a great time or playing a board game together. You're not going to share a photo where the kids are throwing food at each other, you and your husband have fallen out, and you know, that's just not what happens.
Someone's throwing the board game up in the air in a fit of temper because they've just lost.
Exactly. Someone's gone to bed in a huff. I mean, you don't take photos of these moments.
No. Yeah. But perhaps we should.
Yeah. Well, I love the Instagram accounts, actually, where people show the real side of things, you know, when if it's a girl in underwear or bikini or whatever, they show that this is a photograph of them, and if they put the bikini in a certain kind of way, it looks like they're really slim and they've got a tiny waist, but if they move the bikini bottoms down a bit, they've actually got quite a lot of, you know, like a muffin top hanging over the top or something, looking more normal and realistic. And it's so much of it is about the angle and the way you have your clothes, and you can look quite large or quite small depending on all those different things.
Yeah, and it's about also drawing teenagers' attention away from that kind of content as well. So there have been studies that have shown that even anti-anorexia content is linked to disordered eating. So even when you're trying to move teenagers away from it, even just that awareness and thinking about it can cause them to think differently about their bodies and about food. So that would be one element of social media and the online world where parents, I think, could be very, very cautious and careful and probably keep checks on the content that their teenagers are consuming.
Yeah. Yeah, for all of us, if you're looking at content on online, social media and things, you want to be looking at things that make you feel good and feel good about yourself or make you happy, whatever it is to do with travel, to do with reading, to do with makeup, whatever you're interested in, you want to feel good about yourself, not scrolling through pictures that make you feel bad about yourself.
Yeah, and the algorithms can be handy when you've signalled an interest in something that's healthy, but they can be quite destructive when you've signalled an interest in, for example, content about appearance or about depression or other negative aspects.
Yeah, it's quite scary. I watched a documentary on that, how easy and quick it was when setting up a new TikTok account. If you just looked at something to do with depression, how quickly it escalated into quite serious topics that youngsters shouldn't be looking at. Well, I don't even think they should be online at all, but, you know, it's quite frightening, isn't it?
Yes.
So it must have been really interesting putting this book together. How long have you been working on it?
So I started working on it along with my first book, which was back in 2020. That was Evidence-Based Parenting, which is aimed at parents of younger children, aged 2 to 10. And I was looking at some of the topics related to teenagers alongside my work then. But then properly, I was working on it over about a year, kind of between last January, which is when I submitted my draft, and the year before that. And then obviously there's been kind of updates of the research since as well.
Yeah.
So great. It's been big undertaking, a lot of research studies, but very, very interesting. And it's been very useful for my own parenting as well.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah. I mean, that must be a great thing when you're doing the job that you're doing, you know, finding out little nuggets that you think, oh yes, I'll implement that in my own life.
Yeah. My teenagers, they roll their eyes now when I start talking about research.
Oh, I bet. Here she goes again. Brilliant.
Well, somebody get her off the subject.
Yeah. Well, if people want to get a copy of Teenagers, it's out now. It's available on our website, tre.radio, in the bookshop section. And it's by Matilda Gosling, who we've been chatting with. Matilda, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Hannah.
At Ability Chiropractic, we do things differently. We believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Our doctors take the time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, we help restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book an appointment today at abilitychiro.com.